Hi, I'm Steven Rodriguez, and I'm a Pisces, and yeah, totally fits.
I'm Kate Kirschenstein, and I'm a Virgo, but I was born on the cusp, so I also am a Libra in my mind, and sometimes I think I'm more of a Libra.
Hey, I'm Addy Tennell, and I'm an Aquarius, and people say that really makes sense for me.
I'm Amethyst Motavalli, and I'm a Scorpio. It makes perfect sense for me.
So thank you for listening to the first radio broadcast version of Look at These Fucking Artists, which is a conversation series that we started at the Anarchist Book Fair, the fourth annual Anarchist Book Fair that was a couple of weeks ago. And we decided to continue it in this radio format. And so, we're here, and our topic tonight is Comprador. I'm going to let Ami talk about what that is.
Well, I think the first time I was really introduced to the term comprador was through Franz Fanon. But it goes back to a colonial occupation of Hong Kong. And it was basically the person who was the native, who was basically a business person who felt that they would profit off of their relationship with the occupiers. And so Fanon, the way that he talked about it was people who were so-called natives of certain lands who worked with oppressors or occupiers so that it would benefit them, irregardless of the fact that it could potentially in generations to come really not benefit their their offsprings or whatever, their folks. So that was the idea that I had about Comprador. And then Hamid Dabashi went on to kind of expand Comprador and started to talk about people who basically kind of find ways to sell out their culture, sell out their identity, sell out their gender. And they basically do it so that it helps a kind of imperial project, a kind of international colonial project, which is militarized and which is based in surveillance tracking militarization for the sake of profit.
Cool. So I think that we're just going to open it up and kind of start off by talking about some examples from artists that we've run across that that like relate to this topic, and then just open it up for a conversation on kind of how to grapple with this or stop it. I suppose maybe if it's like apropos. So I guess like just speaking from like my own perspective, I feel like the Comprador is like a really I think it's a really apt, like it's a really appropriate idea, just especially relating to like queer and trans communities, because even those aren't really like related to direct colonialism, I think that like queer and especially like trans history is like really rooted in like that kind of like similar colonial domination. And so I think that it's like with especially like right now, like with trans artists, it's just really I feel like I see like a lot of artists out there that are just this is going to be really hard to like not name names or something. I don't know if like we need to do that for the sake of like consistency, but anyway, like I just feel like there are so many like trans artists out there that are like, I'm trans and I'm going to make like all this work about like all of this, and then they're just like shuttled around to like speaking events, and then their career is just like going up and up, and it's like, you know, I can't even be around them in all honesty, because like every time I'm around them, it's like, am I going to like become a part of this like trans like project, you know, that is like just furthering your career? And it's like, I think that like the comprador is like a really, you know, it's an appropriate term for that, because it really is like, there's, it's just shuttling that, those definitions among the rich, and it doesn't like help the communities really that it's supposed to help. It's just like, it's just providing that like translation to that's outside of the community. And then like what the community gets is some really kind of like piss poor performance art that's just like supposed to be brilliant just because it's like trans people or whatever. I don't know. It's just like a problem.
Still trying to figure out if I even like understand what a comprador is, but I kind of don't want to go like on, I don't know, on my like on my rant.
Well, what is your question about it?
Well, so it's specifically like within this like colonialist
It's I think it's basically an occupation which could be a forced takeover of land, of body, of ideology. So it really isn't the classic colonial, but I really think of the colonial the idea of neocolonialism existing in such a different way. That it's not really the same as classic colonialism, where, you know, you used to see the British go into, you know, whatever native country and you know, the very brutal in your face brutality, where now you see it, but it's in the guise of other things. So for me, neocolonialism is you know, police murder. Neocolonialism is the narco wars. Neocolonialism is, you know, militarized occupation basically anywhere. And it's also kind of like, it's the hijacking of information, you know, through media or whatever. So that's kind of how I see it, but. Well, I guess I can talk a little bit about I can talk about a couple of different things. I think, I think that I will actually talk about the subject of Iranian and Middle Eastern art, because I did just come back from a panel, and a woman that I like a lot was on this panel, and a few women that I don't like at all were on the panel, but they were. They were talking about collecting Middle Eastern art, and I guess I just wanted to go because I really just wanted to see what people are saying about Middle Eastern art right now, but and also what people are defining as the Middle East right now and all of that. And I think the first problem was that is the collection of people's thoughts and hearts and hard labor, right? But then also the next thought was the artists that were present on the panel were very much catering to this idea of what Middle Eastern contemporary art should look like. But the whole time the artists were saying, well, we don't want to be categorized. And what if I just made art that was just abstract? Would I still get the opportunities I get? And et cetera, et cetera. And in a sense, I really, I do feel like the artists have a responsibility, but to a certain degree, I don't want to put a lot of the blame on the artists. I really saw most of the blame in the dealers and the historians that were asking all of these questions. And the reason is because I feel like there's a sense that the market that actually supposedly controls art, which people believe controls art. I don't think it does, but people believe controls art, is created as this kind of like overseer over what art production is, right? And so what happens is that people start to create so that they can feed this monster that is the art market, right? So it's almost like sacrifice work. So I see what the artists are doing, almost like creating, like cutting the head off of a chicken so that they can make this this deity happy, you know?
Yeah, I guess there's like, it makes me think that there's like, yeah, I don't know. There's just like so much of that goes on in Los Angeles, with like any group of like identities that like anyone belongs to in art or like in and out of art.
Well, when you say that, that kind of makes me think so much of art is made from a personal place or like a place of expression. And maybe how do you know that you're making work about yourself or from your position of identity?
Yeah.
In a sense, that's authentic and kind of avoids this problem of instrumentalizing and selling out your identity.
Totally. Yeah, no, I had a conversation with an artist recently, and he's a Chicano artist, and he was talking about this like exact same thing. And so he paints these paintings that I think are just like really cliche, and he does like dope ass work outside of the art, like in terms of like organizing and shit like this, and is kind of like I think like having that same problem like within himself, like how does he like break free of this like Chicano identity, but has this like totally different, like sort of like problematic, like universalized idea of art, and this like art as like salvation idea, and then kind of gets stuck in his identity through that, and now he's like a dope person with like all this like great things like to share, but I think like he's like wrestled, like stuck in that identity, and maybe stuck with like being a comprador. And I think that's like what you have to say, where it's this like thing when you're like focused on your like identity or something. Is that what you mean?
I guess I mean more like someone like Salman Rushdie.
Hmm.
Or even whomever it was that basically gave information to the media, etc., that there are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and that, you know, it should be bombed, and it was all falsified information. Of course, that whole thing was like a theater; it was all created theater.
Yeah.
But you know, Salman Rushdie wasn't. So Salman Rushdie actually got a discussion that perhaps should have happened inside a family, and decided to get aspects of it that other people would see as savage, and blow it up and make a big deal about it, because he knew that would get him a lot of notoriety.
Wait, which are you talking about? The Satanic Verses?
Satanic Verses, but also essays he's written, several things he's written. Mm. So, so that it's these extreme situations rather than day-to-day life.
Yeah.
You know, that sometimes it's banal, and sometimes people won't get so like, ah, I can't believe that happened. if they just hear about day-to-day life, they'll probably yawn, most people. So it's not as shocking.
Yeah,
you know?
It's shock value.
As much.
I mean, it's definitely like, I think that the stakes are, I don't want to put like, you know, rate it, but like it seems like the stakes are a lot higher when you're talking about Iran in particular, because it's like just such a like militarized conflict. And so, I mean, when I'm thinking about like, especially like trans artists, it's not like that big of a deal. You know, even at like its worst, like it's just sort of like some people making some money off of like a specific identity. And I feel like, I don't know, like if you would, I don't know if you could say the same about like Chicano artists, because, but I don't feel like I've ever seen like, yeah, I don't know if like there's a, like people giving like fuel to like the fire in the same way that like it happens with like Islamophobia, you know. It's just like, it seems like that is, it's so like, yeah, it's like one of those things that people can just like push, and like they'll like, that helps their career, and at the same time it really, really hurts like real people, you know.
If you don't mind.
Yeah.
But, you know, in a certain sense, I would think that someone who's really exploiting and giving misinformation about trans history is actually is feeding into people's lack of understanding, and in the long term, actually probably opening doors for violence and opening doors for less and less tolerance. So I think that in a lot of ways, it's really comparable. It really is similar. You know, anyone who wants to falsify the what actually went on. I mean, I understand that we all have different perspectives. Like, if I see something from my eyes, it's going to be entirely different from someone else. But really, to falsify it so that it feeds the hunger of people who don't have genuine care for a certain community, rather would like to see how they can profit off of that community, that's very dangerous. It is.
Yeah, no, I and after you said that, it made me, like, I feel like my one, like, anecdote that I wanted to, like, that we're trying to structure this conversation around, like, that made me really think of, like, her work.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure if you're familiar with that one, but she did, like, all of these pictures of various, like, trans icons, and, like, they're really, really beautiful photos, and she's, like, a phenomenal photographer, and so it was sort of, like, it was, like, you know, her trying to enter into these, like, this history, like, this trans history, and finding these, like, heroines from the past. Like, I think it was all, like, trans women and trans women of whiteness, and but, well, I don't know, I don't want to throw, like, I don't want to say that exclusively, but anyway, my point is that, like, it was, like, all of these women that were, like, totally neutered from their politics at the same time. So you have, like, a picture of her with, like, Rumi, and who was, like, one of the Cockettes, and, like, the Cockettes were, like, had all sorts of stuff about, like, communism, and, like, I don't know, their politics were, like, okay, like, but they were, like, overt about, like, their politics. They were, like, about smashing capitalism, and at the same time, they were, like, gender fuck, and, like, trans, and queer, and all of this stuff, but, like, the politics just was, like, absent, and it was just a becomes, like, a two-dimensional image of, like, this, like, older trans woman, and, like, a younger, like, beautiful trans woman, and it's just, like, where's the history with that? And then, of course, it's just, like, fucking, like, the biggest, like, you know, the biggest trans, like, artist, like, ever, you know?
You just made a really good connection for me there, because I think I was sort of seeing the Comprador as a figure that is choosing to highlight certain things and to exploit certain details, and tease out sort of this tantalizingly shocking content. But then you're also pointing out that it can be an act of what you don't say and what you don't choose to highlight, and kind of also an act of erasure, which I think is interesting. We don't really think about what isn't said in artworks and context that is left out.
Yeah. No, I think that's yeah, there was a period, I think a couple years ago, where I was collecting like tons of just super foul things and just like super graphic things. And it's always been something that like was like an easy draw for me. And I think that's also why I always kind of like pick it out. And then so this magazine in Mexico City, there's newsstands that are covered with like different tabloids. Usually it's either like narco violence tabloids or like novella pop star, like women in bikini sort of things. But there's this one that just does it all together. So it's one half of the cover of the magazine is, you know, like three decapitated heads. And then the other half is some like Brazilian supermodel, like topless or something like that. And so it's this like really insane juxtaposition of, yeah, what you were saying, the just this like super shocking display of like sexuality and violence together.
I don't remember the name of the artist that, why do I always forget his name? And he's kind of part of a group of elite, wealthy artists out of Mexico City that did a series of work where he was kind of creating conceptual pieces and documentation around exploiting those types of tabloids, and then mm-hmm. also he did a series where he busted into cars and stole car stereos and then put them on display in galleries. Do you remember who that was? And he's like a super art star. But anyway, so how do you think artists were exploiting?
Exploiting like violence and things like that?
Well, exploiting the already hyper exploitative, like there's already a hyper exploitative media,
yeah,
right? And then exploiting that to the next level, right?
Well, I don't know. I kind of feel like with art in Mexico and the whole violence thing, I feel like it's already like they're dipping into this like whole cachet that already like exists in like Mexican culture, and this like whole idea that Mexican culture like has this like different type of like fascination with death. So it's kind of like, I feel like in that sense, you know, they're just like telling like a new story about it. But I guess the point is like at the end of the day, does that say anything about like narco violence? Does that like do anything? And that's what you're kind of getting at, right?
Right, basically, the fact that it's kitschified.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, it obviously doesn't do, you know, it's just like a fucking like art thing, like it doesn't really do anything. I don't know, I think that I always, when I think about this like whole idea of like graphic imagery, there's that book from that dude, his last name is that Semiotex books that just came out about the femicides and how he represented those photos like through just like at the back of the book, instead of including photos about like violence in Juarez, he like just included the captions that described what the photo did. And I think that was like a successful way as an artist to represent violence in a way that's like kind of like, you know, it digs into you more than just having these like fucking wall of like a lot of my magazines or whatever it is. Like I think like that does a much more successful job of just like getting under your skin, which is kind of interesting. It's the whole like Hitchcock, like, you know, violence off screen sort of horror.
Yeah.
I mean, isn't it at the same time, like, isn't it important to kind of, like, I feel like maybe it's even, like, really important to focus on the way that, like, art is being, I don't want to say consumed, but, like, the way that it's being, like, presented, you know, in the sense that it's, like, how is that, like, how is that feeding in on, like, capitalist alienation, you know? And so it's sort of, like, in terms of just, like, making those images, like, so, like, far from, like, you know, like, further, I don't know. I want to say that, like, that feels like it's just putting those images, like, out of reach. Like, when you create the wall of this, these really horrific images, you know? And it's, like, and I felt like what you were saying with, like, the semiotext artist, it was more like trying to circumnavigate that, you know, and I'm not really familiar with that, but at the same time, like, I feel like, you know, the important thing is saying, like, how is that art, like, framed within, like, the audience, you know, how is the audience, like, going to enter into that piece, and, like, I feel like it's really important because, like, that either, in my book, like, determines whether or not it's, like, I mean, it's not 100%, but, like, it's more easy to, like, become a, like, commercialized and, like, an artifact in, like, some form of domination, like, colonial domination or whatever, but, like, it's a lot easier to, like, become that artifact if it's, like, framed in this, like, way, like, this kind of, I don't know, even, like, in a, like, a museum sort of style, like, now I'm just kind of, like, going crazy, but... You know what I mean? It's sort of like, how do you, like, how can you have a commitment to a community if, like, your community, the ones that are, like, are consuming that, are, like, outside of that community?
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Well, I don't know, and that's, like, the problem, I think, like, or the difference, like, these are, like, rich artists from Mexico, like, it's not, they're not fucking organizers, and at the end of the day, they have, like, they have no intention to do anything that involves organizing anyone or anything. It's just, like, you know, like, I'm just gonna make this, like, fucking little conceptual thing, and it's going to have some, like, cultural aesthetic, and this is going to be, like, an interesting foul cultural aesthetic. I don't know, and I also think with that, I don't know if this is what you were saying, but there's also this, like, whole international art world game at play, like, obviously, I don't know, I went to school in Mexico City, and that was, like, a fucking trip, like, being, I didn't do, like, too many art world things while I was in Mexico City, it was mostly just, like, spending time in, like, anarchist community centers and stuff like that, and then I kind of was, like, I've always, like, had an appreciation, or, like, just an interest in, like, I don't know, rich Mexicans is, like, kind of, like, a weird phenomenon for me, like, growing up and then kind of, like, figuring it out, and, like, it's not a world that, like, I ever had access to, and so it's really fucking interesting, like, walking into it and seeing what it looks like. But the crazy thing about that school is I think I came in at the end of, like, a summer, like, it was, like, during the summer, so it was the end of, they have, like, a summer class, and I just, like, it's just, like, weird. It's, like, this, like, weird, like, international school in Mexico where people just kind of, like, purchase this, like, fucking Mexican cachet. And, like, I think all the art, all the student artists who were there were kind of pressed to, like, make artwork based on their summer in Mexico. And it was really kind of offensive because all of their pieces, like, every fucking piece, except for maybe one, was just, like, a pile of trash on a table. And it was, like, serious? Like, this is, like, what you dig out of, like, Mexico City is that it's like, you know, you just, it's like dirty and there's like fucking trash everywhere and you're just gonna pick it all up and like put it on a table. Like, and then the worst part is too, is like everybody there is like speaking English. Like, and it was really funny because we brought one of our roommates that we were living with, and he's like a super fresa. He has like nothing to do with like, he's just like a Mexican, like hardcore fresa kid. And he was just like totally tripped out, even more than like we were. And just like didn't, he this dude doesn't go to museums or anything. He's like into like soccer and like business school. But I don't know, it was just like a really weird experience. And I feel like that's like Compador, yeah.
Yeah, well, that like just sounds like super anthropological, you know, like going through the trash and like trying to discover this other culture, you know, and it's like, it just feels like really dangerous to mix that with like public discourse, because like that's what art is. It's like a mode of discourse in a way. So it's like, it just feels like weird to, or I mean, it feels like really dangerous to take that kind of like model and put it in that realm of like, you know, like public consumption. Because it's just like, yeah, I mean, it just turns it into, I mean, it's just power. I mean, that's like a problem with like anthropology back in the day. It was like an expression of that colonial power, you know, and it, the modes of how that other culture were displayed were just like continued that power dynamic, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, art feels like it kind of like falls into that same, like, that same pattern, maybe. Like, I mean, and that would make a lot of sense. Like, well, like, why, you know, that makes me like wonder, like, why do we like fall back on these like particular tropes for like display, you know, like in terms of this kind of like vitrines and you know, a lot of space and like white walls. And obviously people have like written all this stuff about it, but like now it's making me feel like, since we're talking about colonialism and like all of this stuff, it makes me feel like there's like a direct correlation to that like power structure and like the reason why. I don't know, it's just like food for thought, I guess.
In your example, Stephen, I found myself kind of just like enjoying your story for a moment, and then I realized, wait a second, like, how do I label who's the comprador in this situation? And the more that you think about it, and I think this is how you meant it, but I, for a moment, almost lost it, which is the really interesting part, that it's his school, and he's selling this education that is, in a sense, a colonial moment, and that's a incredibly like strange twist, I think, on the idea of the way that compradors are sometimes operating in an art milieu, because normally it's just evident in the objects that artists end up producing or performances. But this is that moment in a pedagogical context, which I think makes it all the more complicated.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, and there's this like weird, I think, relationship with like schools and the U.S. and maybe like international places, or like schools in Mexico, and just like students abroad and like all these different things. There's another person who's like a critical pedagogy writer, and his name's, you guys know him? Yeah, yeah. Apparently that dude has like a pedagogy school in like Baja, and it's like fucking crazy expensive to go there. And like, it's this kind of like same thing where it's like the University of Phoenix of like fucking critical pedagogy schools, if like something can exist like that. Yeah, yeah. And I think that's just like another weird thing. Because like, I've always, there's a really dope school in Oaxaca that this dude Gustavo Esteva runs, and it's something like I would be like, it would be amazing, I think, just to like pick up organize, like work with them on what they do. And I got to visit them, and it wasn't like any of these other schools I'm talking about. But there, you know, there's a few international students and like a few students. Most of them are like people in Oaxaca who are like going to this school, and it's like a tiny like seminar. But I think that's like, it's this weird thing. It's like I guess is like the future or something, where we have like schools doing these like weird comprador like fucking thing. And I guess it's because it's like a life, like everything I think is like so lifestyle based now, you know, like you can't just like get an education, but you need to like pick up a lifestyle. And I don't even think that just like exists in like art. Like,
you know, in the way that, and I don't mean to academicize it at all, because I don't feel like I have that, I have a footing in that. But in the way that Hamid Debashi was talking about the comprador, he certainly kind of lays out the comprador, and in particular talks about, you know, the brown comprador that is basically working on elements of Islamophobia, etc. But he also really says that there is a point of desperation that happens when we become so internally colonized, mm-hmm. that we feel like there are no other choices. So it gets to the point that it's almost like a psychological, like it's a psychosis, right? And that psychosis is driven by a machine that really makes us feel like we all need, like there's one biscuit that's thrown out, and that we all need to jump for that biscuit and fight with each other for it. So ultimately, he did like really call out, he said it's really important, and he named names actually, which is really detrimental to his career. But he named names, and he called it out, and he said, but ultimately, we got to call these people out, but we do have to say that what they're doing is out of a psychosis and reaction to this machine that is making us feel this way.
Do you feel like then that that's a call for further critique, or a call for empathy, or maybe both, or, you know, could you speculate on how that dialogue should maybe go forward?
Well, I mean, I personally think that it's a call for people not to believe that not to buy into that psychosis, to work in ways to heal themselves from that psychosis and to create alternatives. And by creating their own alternatives, giving less importance to the comprador, less and less importance to the comprador. I think that like, 10% of, I feel like 10% of my job is to call out compradors. And I used to think that it was like 90% of my job. But it was wearing me out, and it was making a lot of enemies. And I realized that, well, some of these folks, I really like them. And I feel where they're coming from. So I thought, well, 10% is for me to call out the comprador, and I will call out the comprador to their face. You know, I will. I don't personally right now want to call out names, because I feel like people should be prepared for that. You know, I feel like they should be right here and be able to defend themselves if need be. But then 90% of my job now, I really feel like, is finding alternatives, finding things that bring me happiness and connect me with the communities that I love. And then also not just thinking alone, like how can I work in ways that make the communities that I love happy too. So, but you know, then it just kind of shifts the like what gets under my skin. Actually, I feel like it gives me fuel to create an alternative.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's like, I wish that I had that. I feel like I want to get to that point for myself. I feel, yeah, those kind of strategies are so important because I feel like these kind of things just tend to like, I dwell on them. Like, I'm in this, like, 90%, like, feeling like I need to, like, call out and, like, rage against the machine. And then the 10% is, like, it's too little, though, you know? I really, yeah, I think it needs to, yeah. So, I don't know, what's kind of stuff would you...
Well, you know,
what kind of stuff do you do?
I actually think, from my perspective, I see it reverse. I rarely have heard you get very snarky about people, and I've heard you call out a name one time, and I've seen you actually create alternatives over and over and over again, constantly working towards alternatives. So maybe it's what's happening in your brain, but your actions are entirely different.
Yeah, that's awesome.
You know, I mean, I'm sure it's wearing on you psychologically, but it sounds like you're doing exactly what we were talking about, that you're working to, like, beat out that psychosis, you know. We all get internally or called, you know, I feel it all the time. Hey, I know. Now maybe we can go around and see if people fit their signs.
Like, reflect on it. Okay. I don't know. Do we reflect on our own sign or each other's?
Each other's.
That's a good idea. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Really,
I like that a lot.
Anything about signs.
Make it up.
Okay.
Be like, I really think that.
Let's see. You know what? I would characterize the actual entire conversation, though, as a Virgo conversation. It was kind of a Virgo conversation.
Maybe like when we got the mic, we really wanted to say something.
Yeah.
And so like to say the right thing.
Yeah.
Because the mics maybe made it a little tricky.
Yeah, it was like this kind of. Need to be articulate, you know.
Yeah.
That's a very Virgo thing. Yeah.
Addie, I don't know if you were as Aquarian as you normally are. I might offer that.
Although the fan.
The fan, yeah. For those of you listening at home, Addie's been fanning herself with an elaborate black lace fan this entire time. So that was kind of fanciful. And Aquarian.
Creamy champagne colored outfit.
Quite nice.
Subtly, not overtly sexist. Sexy.
That's cute.
Sexy outfit.
Well, I was in love with an Aquarius once, and he was subtly sexy, subtly sexist.
My ex-girlfriend was on this crazy fucking Mexican dating show called Dulce Corazones, and the whole premise is that it's like you go on and you have your like zodiac sign like posted on your outfit, and it's always themed. So like when she did it, there was like an Egyptian theme, so she was like and there's this dude who's this like mystic, like he's a mystic period, like he's not like a mystic for like like he's like a mystic, like I don't know what he really is, but so there's that. And what they do is they have like the men's side and then like the female side, and they're all like posted up with their like so for the Egyptian theme, like they had their like white dresses, like nylon dresses on, like costumes. And like the little hats, and then the men were wearing like they were like shirtless and wearing like togas, I guess, but like around their waist, like I don't know. Yeah, it's so they wear their signs, and they give everybody like the wrong sign, like it's not your sign, like it's just like like, she was the Sagittarius on the show, but that's, like, not her sign. And then based on, like, how sexy you get, that's how you, like, advance into the next levels and, like, earn more cash, which is kind of cool. Because, like, I don't know, you can end up making a lot of cash. But,
did she make a lot of cash?
No, she got kicked off. She was the first person who got kicked off.
Oh, man.
It was kind of, like, yeah, kind of a bummer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she made like, I think it was like $150. No, it's not bad at all. It's funny. It's recorded in like a studio in Burbank, and it's like in a burned down Western like set, like an old Western set that's like the front part is had a fire, and then behind it is this like fucking crazy Dulce Corazones like show. Oh, and then the woman who runs, and this is actually the biggest show, if I'm not wrong, in, like, it's, like, one of the top shows in the entire world, so it's, like, super popular in, like, all of Latin America, and, like, all over Europe, it's super popular, and it's, like, syndicated, like, crazy.
Wow.
Yeah. Check it out. Dulce Corazones.
There was a time when people ruled the Intergalactic Mining and Cloning Empire, LLC, and it was not rad. Then, the humans, they made clones, and that was rad. And we made humanity into a farm for genetic material, and that was rad. It's totally rad how it works. A human is grown to maturation, and then the most important material is extracted. Then, the human contract is terminated. Which is rad, because after that...